You may have been listening to the recent series The Magical Memory Tour on the Source FM over the last few weeks. This program is a documentary about people like Anne Harrow and Vicky Hurd who worked on that series, and about others working on oral history projects locally. You'll hear more from Anne and Vicky about the making of the Magical Memory Tour, and then from another group of people who've been working on an oral history project supported by Falmouth University and the University of Northumbria. This involved the Heritage Collection at Constantine's Tolman Centre and the Penryn Museum. My name is Mac Dunlop, and I'll be back to give you more information about those places and projects at the end of this program.
Hello, my name is Anne Harrow, and I've been working on the Magical Memory Tour at Source Radio on 96.1 FM. What I'm doing is absolutely the first time I've done anything like this. Absolutely the first time. And I don't know how I did it. I just walked into the station and got talking to Matthew, and I ended up doing these programs.
Amazing.
But I listened to all your recordings, and I thought how well you did, how you drew those people out, and they were comfortable and they relaxed. They were a bit like that, I think, the first words, and then they just relaxed. Did they all know you?
No.
I wondered if they knew you.
No. I think I probably only knew about, if I recorded 18 people, I probably only knew two or three. Some people knew, because I come from a long line of Penryn people, my family. Some people, that was a nice way in for some people, that they knew my granny and my auntie. And I'm Vicky Hurd. Over the last 10 years, I've done a series of memory recordings in and around Penryn, and that material is currently being used for the local radio programme.
Does that feel right there?
Yeah, that's there, fine. That's fine. Yeah, that's fine. It's on, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
Too late.
You're supposed to talk.
All right, Joan, could you tell me when you were born?
Yes.
And where you were born?
Yeah. Well, I was born in St. Gluvy Street in Penryn just 83 years ago, just over 83 years ago, near the bottom of St. Gluvy Street. So I'd say that I was born under St. Gluvy Street church bells, because we was always right listening to bells. That's why I'm so used to bells ringing.
So what year was that you were born?
1920.
It was Mary Jane Collins and John Pope. She kept groceries and clothes and a gossip shop as well. She was a most peculiar old soul. She always had to wear glasses, but funnily enough, they was always up here.
On top of her head?
Yeah. Lard used to come in 28-pound boxes in May days, and margarine. Lots of times, if somebody came in for some lard and margarine, Mary Jane would cut the cat off the box and measure out the margarine. Oh, dear. I can tell you some things about that shop.
It was a lovely life there, because we could look out our bedroom window and look all the way across St. Mawes up towards St. Austell. It wasn't so nice in the war when you could see Plymouth burning night time. That was quite horrific, you know.
So that was it. You went and chatted to people, and did you structure a list of questions that you wanted to ask everyone?
Yeah, I did. I kind of had a framework. I had in mind quite a clear picture of what I wanted to get out of the project, what I wanted to find out from people. And that was basically, as I've just said, what was life like for people growing up in Penryn in the last century or 50 years ago or whatever.
When I was at John Julian's, I think it was £1.50 or equivalent to £1.50
a week.
And when I was serving me Tom, he was a Roman Catholic, and we used to have, if you had work up at Tremole, you would make windows, doors, anything, any joinery, any timber, and you got to push it from Quarry Hill in Falmouth all the way up to Tremole.
When you say push it, what, on a cart?
Anchor, no transport in them days. Now, we used to have to push it on an anchor.
And with that objective in mind, I just made a list of appropriate questions so that the answers would meet that objective, really.
How did you end up choosing who to interview?
Well, it was just... we had a sort of send out messages within the community who knows somebody who might be prepared to come along and talk to me. So that was it, really. It was sort of networking and finding people who were comfortable and happy about it, really.
Did they come to you?
I think 100% I went to them. People are much more relaxed.
Yes, in their home. In their own home. I was wondering, yes, yes. And one of them is a clock chiming, a beautiful clock.
So yes. I interviewed an old gentleman, the television was on all the time in the background, and another gentleman I interviewed, it was his budgerigar was singing all the way through, but it was quite nice, really.
Of course, that's what you want, though, isn't it? Yes.
So, Anne, when you listen through all those recordings, were you looking for sounds like that?
No, I wasn't. I was given them. And they were put on. I listened to a couple at the radio station, and then they were put onto my transferred to my computer. And so I sat at home and listened. There were 16, an hour each. Yes. And I, the first time I listened was two or three at the radio station, and I didn't do anything. I just listened, and had a few tears, and then I felt that I could put them into sections. Into subjects.
Wondering whether we should just kind of go around and say who we all are. And that.
I'm Tracy Clowes. I am volunteer curator at Constantine, which is the other half of the project with Penryn.
Vicky Hurd was a volunteer at Penryn Museum for about 10 years.
I'm Jackie Hessing. I'm a volunteer at Constantine.
John Kirby from Penryn Museum.
Being a museum, I think we tend to concentrate on older people. But I remember talking to somebody up at the university and they said, no, you should be recording people that are moving to the town now, because in 50 years, 20 years' time, it'll all be different.
I used to go to Penryn years ago because you had a really good charity shop, really old-fashioned charity shop with loads and loads of... It was obviously a nice, old, big, interesting shop once. Just thinking about, not thinking about the post office and the spa shop, but to save the children, it's a different kind of shop.
It is, actually.
I could organise that.
And now so you're recording.
Okay, all right then.
Go on, say something.
Hello, I'm recording something. Good.
All right, then you can start.
Right, I'm Sally Coote, 68 years old, lived in Constantine all my life, worked in volunteer in Save the Children for 17 years.
Why did you volunteer in the shop?
Well, I volunteered in the shop because I had a friend that worked there, and when I gave up my work, she said, why don't you come down and help me with the shop? We used to do a couple of hours a day, and then it got a few more days. That's why I was down as volunteer for Save the Children, because my friend was down there, so I went with her.
It's changed quite a lot then since you've been there.
Oh, yes, it has. Yeah. Yeah.
So in what way? How's it?
The shop that we're in now has been there, I think, we moved in there about 6 or 7 years ago. We were in next door for a number of years. But the charity shop for Save the Children in Constantine started in 1970 with the Thatch Cottage down here, on the corner. Miss Hawkins. Mary Hawkins started up Save the Children charity shop from that cottage. She didn't live in that cottage, she just rented the downstairs rooms for the shop.
What I loved about that recording was the lady's accent.
Yeah, that
one. I'm really, really interested in local accents, yeah. And they are fast disappearing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And also, as we were saying the other day, you could tell where somebody came from, yeah. Couldn't you? When you were
I can tell a Truro accent and a Farnworth accent.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I'm talking to Mrs. Jenny Dunford. Now, Jenny, when you worked at number 20 Lower Market Street, what sort of shop was it?
Well, it's a charity shop supporting orphanages in Romania.
And were you paid for that work?
No, it's all voluntary. No, we did it for the fun of it, really. And I can remember one time Sylvia saw this lady putting a pair of shoes in a bag and walking out the shop. So Sylvia, who was, you know, quite elderly, went running up the street after her, affronted her and said, "You've got some shoes you haven't paid for." And she said, "Oh, no, I haven't, no, I haven't." She said, "Yes, you have." And Sylvia opened the bag there with the shoes. So this woman flew them down the pavement and ran off.
I had my list with me, so if she hesitated and didn't know what to say next, and you kind of sensed that, well, then I had a number of questions that I could have come in with. But she was
very good,
very articulate, very...
good memory. And she
was very relaxed. She relaxed as the recording went on.
I felt really, really out of my depth a lot of the time, and I was just sort of scared that, you know, she was going to dry up. I know this is Sally we're talking about, and she's hardly likely to, but but it's just, you know, I was... And listening back to it, it sounds a bit stilted, you know. I just felt, yeah, obviously I need more experience in doing it. And it's all the things that are going through it, and there was me worrying about the machine.
I know, I used to find that the most stressful thing of all is the bloody machine. Because I didn't know, it frightens me, really.
Yes, it does me too.
I think because it's a very different kind of focus where the machine is... these buttons and it's technical, whereas if you're talking with somebody, it's about the empathic and the social, and you have to be really open and attentive, and it's a different focus. So you have to switch between those two all the time. But
well, thank you very much. Is there anything else at all that you'd like to tell us about the charity shop and working there?
I don't think so, really. When we knew it was going to close, we sort of, you know, were worried about it. But then it remained open for a little bit longer when they were to close it. And because it was something to do with the listed shelves. The shelves in the shop, they had not to be taken down because they were listed, which seems a bit unusual. You get listed building. I've never heard of listed shelves before. So anyway, we're quite pleased because that was an issue with the wine bar opening. Yeah. So we were able to keep on a little bit longer.
Yeah. We decide to develop the wine bar. We might end up with two recordings, but the museum also knows a lot of the history of that shop. And we talked about this already, that you could actually put together a package, couldn't you? We were talking about actually giving it to the wine bar to play in there. Right. But we also said perhaps we could have one of those... where people could just click on it and access a little program about that shop.
There's more, it just depends when you finalise what it is that you actually want to do, then get more people interested.
Right.
I think those numbers are quite
a good number to start off to decide what we're doing and stuff, because otherwise too many people and you've got too many cooks.
Occasionally people would sort of, you know, bamboozle you, saying they'd paid for things or hiding things underneath other coats, you know, a big coat or something like that, and hide them amongst that. Which was awful, really.
Did they sometimes try and knock down the price?
Oh, yes, they did. I mean, it was cheap enough as it was. They used to try and bargain with you. We said, no, sorry, we can't, you know, really, in a charity shop, it's for charity.
Yeah.
And the some people would say, well, it's for charity. They thought it was for them, you know, but it's really for the orphans in Romania.
I really like that idea that we came up with.
Doesn't it? Mm-hmm. All fits together, really.
What is your motivation for being a volunteer?
I've never done any volunteering before, and I thought, well, I'll give it a go. But having done it now for a number of years, I have a different view about volunteering now as what I had. I think a lot more people should try it. just to get an idea of actually doing something for other people for no sort of personal kind of financial gain, because you do get something from it. I mean, I have over the years. Yeah, I like to think, well, everybody has a story, and as far as Constantine's concerned, you know, the story, it's got people who worked in the quarries, I'm not sure how many people, they always had a story in it, but sadly, every so often, you know, somebody disappears and you think, oh, did we get the recording of them talking about their quarrying days? Yeah. I know. So it's that, it's kind of putting people's stories on record.
After, when the boy became 16, he either became a quarryman, carried on as a quarryman, or became a stonecutter, or maybe a blacksmith. My brother was a blacksmith, a toolsmith. And one of the holes we bored in the quarries was from an inch, 2 inches for powder, and the big ones were 3 inches, 4 inches, 5 inches, and 6 inches. So I never saw more than a 4-inch hole bored when I was. These were called muckle holes, which is Scottish for big holes. After that, we learned to stop to cut stone.
I do like the idea of oral history, you know, because you've got to get it before it goes, if you see what I mean. And I've been listening to those the things on Radio 4, you know, the oral history project thing they've been doing, and you know, I mean, it's just been absolutely fascinating. I just wanted that, you know, wanted us to do something like that.
So, have you got any special memories of your customers, either funny or sad? Have you?
They don't come in and open up to you, not really, and no. Say, you know, and be sad and things like that. Well, today it was funny today because he's down there, and a gentleman, I've never seen the gentleman before, perhaps he's a holiday maker, and he came in and he was so thrilled with what he had. God, it's the best charity shop around, he said. You know, oh, he said, I've had a lovely time in the charity shop here today, you know. Yeah. And it was, that was good. That was good, the old chap. That's nice. God, it's lovely, he said. He said, you're taking all my money. I said, well, that's what we're here for, taking all the money.
How did you end up?
How did I get into it? Well, I guess two things happened, really. I retired from work and joined Penryn Museum because I'm a Penryn person and have always been really interested in the history of Penryn, because I think there's a lot of hidden stuff out there still to be discovered. And I also began to think about ordinary people's lives in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at photographs, film archive, you can read books, you can look at paintings, but it doesn't really tell you the real experiences of people. And I thought a lot about this. And at the same time, I realised there were a whole bunch of people out there who perhaps only had 2 or 3 more years to live. And once they'd gone, all those memories were just gone to go with them.
Do you know who actually owned the shop?
I don't know at all. No. I don't know if it was the man who had the men's outfitters before that. I don't know if he still owned it.
So what we're going to do is, I'm just going to ask you some simple questions about 20 Lower Market Street, which was your family shop, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And ask you some of the things that you remember about it.
Right.
All right. So I'm just going to start off with an official statement. This recording was made on September the 27th, 2012. Canon Geach and his sister Mary are remembering 20 Lower Market Street, Penryn. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Fine. Now, 20 Lower Market Street is now a wine bar. But you don't remember it like that, do you?
No.
Can you tell us how you remember number 20 Lower Market Street?
Would you like to know a bit about who was there when my grandfather went in there?
Oh, right. So was it your grandfather that started the business?
No, he took it on from Mr. Michael Levin, who was the mayor, somewhere around here, and he had a business there.
Well, the shop was quite large. I haven't been in there much lately, but it seemed very long, and all the shelves down the side were left over from when it was a men's outfitter. And there was a little tiny office where we used to try and sort things out, and a little tiny sink where you could make yourself a cup of tea, and a counter, and a terribly old-fashioned, what they call money machine, till. And I mean, it was just useless being a till, really. But you just put the money in; it didn't tell you what change to give or anything like that. We just had to work that out in our heads and write it down on bits of paper.
How did you think your recording went? Because that was one of the first times that you...
Yeah, it was the first time I'd done it for something like this. But I don't know, I found it really difficult because I mean, believe it or not, I am quite shy and I don't like, you know, sort of forcing people to talk. And I mean, I had to have my list of things to ask her. And she wanted to sit. She wanted a copy of that as well before I went in. So she said, "Oh, I want to know what you're going to ask me." So I got her a copy of that. And but I did. I just find it really difficult because I'm not really a spontaneous person. Really, I like to really think about what I'm going to say, and that's no good on a tape. Really, spending ages thinking about things.
What sort of customers do you get in the shop?
They are mainly local because it's a shop where, you know, been there a long time and same sort of, say, a lot of the customers that comes in have been coming with us for lots of years, have been visiting lots of, you know, coming in lots of times. So we do get occasional visitors, yes, we do. Yeah. And we do get people from Falmouth, Brigg, Carner Downs, which comes maybe once a month or so and sees us. But the visitors, they come. Some come every year and they say to me, "Oh, you aren't still here then." "God, you was here last time, you was here a year before," and all that, you know, ones that come down every year.
Yeah.
So, "Oh, God, you aren't still here." "Yeah, I'm still here." So you do get to know them and remember them from each year.
Yes.
But like you say, most of the people are local with families, that they come and they can get a bargain.
Yes.
So.
Yes. But I also tried to contact people and let them know what was happening.
Yes.
But I think I managed to find four people. One gentleman didn't want to listen, but he said it was all right to... It was his wife talking. He said it was all right to broadcast that. And I spoke to Betty Jenking, but I haven't been able to find her since. I don't know if she's still living where she was. I've been trying to phone her and let her know that the programmes are going out. And I also spoke to Richard Pippyhead, the son of Richard Pippyhead.
Yes.
That was interesting. Mm-hmm. Did you know about him going to the... somewhere in Falmouth, somewhere commercial, and this chair was there, and the chap in wherever it was said to him, "Sit in that chair," and it was, of course, the chair from the museum, and he sat in the chair, and a voice started talking, and it was his father.
Oh, wow.
And he was just completely taken aback. That's strange. But he was fine, he was lovely, he was fine.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying he doesn't know why they're called Pippi, but they're all called Pippi. His father was called Pippi. Mm.
Pippyhead.
And then they've all been called Pippi and he doesn't know why.
No.
And I believe he has a pasty shop now in Penryn.
Yes.
And I tried to ring him to tell him that it was going up, but I couldn't.
But otherwise, over there in Gladney Place, it was a good place.
Yes.
Help one another.
Yes.
There were big families over there.
Yes.
Big families. There used to be the Rundles and all of them, the Gilberts.
Yes.
You know, several.
And all Webbers. All the children got on, and I guess you could play outside, couldn't you, in the street?
Playing around.
Tell me what you did as a little boy going out to play. Tell me the sort of things you got up to.
Oh, play football in the round up there, like, because there weren't cars then like that today. Or go up the craft and have a bit of fun on a sheet of galvanised down over the hill, like, you know. God, dirty. But on the whole, well, you used to go up her college and all day.
Yes.
You'd have a couple of sandwiches and a bottle of water.
All sorts of issues about talking to people who are not used to hearing their own voice for a long time. They're quite often quite intimidated by the fact that they are being recorded, although we have to remember they did actually agree in the first place. They're embarrassed, sometimes they're tongue-tied, sometimes they're self-demeaning. Oh, I don't know what you want to know from me. I don't think I've got very much to say to you. And yet they've agreed. Uh-huh. So in a way, they've been quite flattered to have been asked to talk about their past. And so getting them to be really relaxed is absolutely essential. And so what I used to do is phone them or call around before, or perhaps a week before. I'd sort of introduce myself, so I'm not a complete stranger coming into their home. We're machine. Already friends.
With this machine.
Yes, that's right. So, you know, it's a face they know, and we have a bit of a chat. But I've also given them a list of the sort of things I'd like them to be thinking about, because there's nothing worse, is there, to be asked a question out of the blue. There's no preparation, you've had no time to think about it.
That's a good idea.
And, of course, the older the person, the longer they take to recall. So that's what I did. I used to do as much preparation before those interviews and recordings that I could.
That was very sensible.
Yes.
Yes, because people think they're ordinary.
Of course, yes.
Don't we?
Yes.
We all think we're ordinary people.
Yes. And if you think about it, you think, what would I possibly say? But if somebody asks you to think about a question...
And they're always very personal to them, like, you know, your home life before school and school and your mum and dad and brothers and sisters. So, you know, the fact that they're talking about themselves is helps.
Talking about the behaviour of their mother and father and grandmothers.
Yes.
Yes, it's very personal, isn't it?
And, of course, it's really important as the person asking the questions to appear really interested.
Yes.
And encouraging and enthusiastic.
Yes,
this lots
is what
of smiles and nods.
This is what I thought you did. This is what I thought you did. I thought it was lovely.
Because there's nothing worse than talking to somebody who you feel is bored to tears.
Yeah.
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 No, we wouldn't know that, would we?
No.
No.
Well, that's a brief look into how people make oral history archives and programs like the Source FM's Magical Memory Tour. Most of the newer documentary and audio archive material you've listened to was coordinated by myself and Natalia Ernstman. It was facilitated by the CARM research group of Dr. Fiona Hackney at Falmouth University, Professor Anne Light, and Katie Hill at Northumbria University. The CARM project was funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council, and you can find out more by visiting the website at howwemadeithappen.org. We'd like to thank John Kirby at Penryn Museum, Jackie, Tracy, and Simon Hamling from the Tolman Centre in Constantine, as well as Gerald Trethorn. Anne and Vicky, of course, who you've heard, and thanks too to James Bunce for his original music. If you'd like to find out more about making local oral history, get in touch with The Source FM, or contact either the Tolman Centre or Penryn Museum. My name is Mac Dunlop, and thanks for listening.